The US sends more troops to the Middle East as some Iranian proxies stage more attacks on US bases in the region and others strike at Israel. A retired Israeli colonel tells us what she thinks Iran is trying to achieve.
To show their support for the Hamas attack, for the Hamas resistance, as they'll put it, without Iran becoming the focus.
Plus, a VOA Persian reporter in Israel shares what people are telling him about Iran's connection to the Israel-Hamas war.
When I talk with any politician in Israel, when I talk with any ordinary people, they put the finger on Iran.
And the death of an Iranian teenage girl apparently assaulted by police for not wearing a hijab leads to another government crackdown on dissent. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The U.S. Defense Department said Tuesday that 300 more U.S. troops will deploy to the U.S. Central Command region, which includes the Middle East. It said the reinforcements are meant to improve force protection and deter Iranian proxies that have attacked U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria 27 times since October 17th. Only minor injuries have been reported among U.S. troops. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin warned against further attacks on U.S. forces when he spoke to a Senate committee on Tuesday.
Our personnel have come under repeated attack in recent days by Iranian-backed militia groups, and these attacks must stop. At the president's direction, U.S. forces have conducted precision self-defense strikes on facilities in eastern Syria used by Iran's IRGC and its affiliates. If Iranian-backed groups continue to attack U.S. forces, we will not hesitate to take further necessary measures to protect our people.
Iranian proxies in Iraq began their latest strikes on U.S. bases in the region days after U.S. ally Israel declared war on Hamas, another Iranian proxy that launched a terror assault on Israel on October 7th. Since then, Israel also has faced repeated aerial attacks by other Iranian proxies in Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. Israel has launched retaliatory strikes in Lebanon and Syria while stating it does not seek a wider conflict. Retired Colonel Miri Eisen is a former Israeli military spokesperson and now directs counterterrorism studies at Israel's Reichman University. I asked her by phone Tuesday what the proxy attacks say about Iran's strategy.
Iran is mainly trying to make sure that they're not the focus, to show their support for the Hamas attack, for the Hamas resistance, as they'll put it, for the Palestinian cause, as they'll put it, without Iran becoming the focus. What does that mean? That they are probably the ones making sure that Hezbollah does not join in. Hezbollah's capabilities are Iran's capabilities, and Hezbollah is participating in a very low-key way. But if they're not allowing Hezbollah to participate in full, what they're doing is making sure that the Houthis in Yemen, the different Hezbollah forces inside Iraq, and the Shiite forces in Syria are all doing actions to show that they support, again, without the focus falling back at Iran.
When you consider that these attacks from Syria, for example, and from the direction of Yemen have not caused, let's say, significant casualties or damage within Israel, does it appear that the attackers know they're not being effective? Do they realize what they're doing is purely symbolic?
Is Iran only doing lip service towards the Palestinian cause, as they're going to say that? So they're willing for their proxies that don't really have capabilities anyways. Those are the ones on the Golan Heights, the Syrian ones, and the proxies that have more capabilities, both in Iraq and in Yemen, to do different types of attacks. The ones that have been done against the United States, certainly in Iraq, in the Syrian, Iraq, Jordanian area, and from Yemen, have had some impact. I can wonder about the capabilities. After October 7th, I'm trying not to underestimate anything.
When it comes to Hezbollah, you mentioned that it appears Iran is holding it back. The leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, has been communicating that he'll make his own decisions about what to do, about what's best from his point of view. So what do you think is really going on between Iran and Hezbollah?
Hassan Nasrallah can say from here to eternity that he's making his own decisions. Hassan Nasrallah is most definitely doing what Iran wants. Iran built an enormous system based on Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Lebanese, Arabic-speaking Shiites. But the system that they built of the 150,000 variety of rockets and other types of payloads, together with the semi-military terror force, the Radwan force, these are things that Iran built to be able to protect Iran from an Israeli attack, from a U.S. attack. They are holding Hezbollah back. I don't know that Hassan Nasrallah would participate more. I do think that he's only holding back right now because Iran has told them to do so.
How much of a factor in Iran apparently holding Hezbollah back is to do with the forces that the U.S. has put into the region, the naval forces in the Mediterranean, and with Israel having threatened to retaliate very severely against Lebanon should there be an all-out offensive by Hezbollah?
Hezbollah and its backer Iran have very clearly stated that Israel is the small devil, Satan, and the United States is the big one. And as I said, they've already been attacking with different Iranian proxy forces against U.S. targets throughout the Middle East. There's been an enormous rise in that over the last 3 weeks. When we're talking right now about Hezbollah joining in, Hezbollah itself is not deterred, I don't think. They have been systematically attacking in a very specific line up north. I think, again, that they're more being held back. The U.S. forces coming in, sure, helps deterrence. But at the end, Israel has an enormous strength that we have not used. Everybody's looking towards Israel against Hamas in the south. We are not using the bulk of our force there. We are keeping that to be sure that Hezbollah doesn't have any other choices. So it's hard to say which one is more impacting when it comes to Hezbollah. The Israeli force, the added in U.S. force, it's very important, but it's not the only one.
What kinds of capabilities would Israel bring to bear against a massive attack by Hezbollah onto Israel?
You've just asked the most difficult question. Should we preempt or shouldn't we preempt? Because essentially, if we preempt, perhaps we could stop some of those capabilities. And if we don't preempt, how would we respond? So Hezbollah has everything that we saw from Hamas times 10. And way more. When I say way more, there's been an open supply line, ground line from Iran through Iraq, through Syria, to Hezbollah, both in Syria and in Lebanon for over a decade. Look at what Hamas, which was relatively isolated, built inside the Gaza Strip with that Iranian backing, inside the Gaza Strip, both with the tunneling and with a different type of weaponry. What Hezbollah gets are exact munitions, different types and capabilities that, as I like to say, on the terror shelf that you go and buy, if you send in now an enormous amount of cheap, easy payloads, and they come on and in with explosives, they're going to have horrific implications.
Well, maybe an even tougher question here. What do you think is going to happen? How do you see this conflict unfolding in the coming days and weeks?
Our eyes are open. We are set and ready. I most definitely think that Hezbollah could still join in. I don't know if that means that Israel will preempt or will not, but the threat of what Hezbollah has in Lebanon on our northern border is one that we cannot ignore. After what Hamas did on October 7th, Hezbollah has been planning that type of plan from the north for almost 5 years, showing it overtly, conquer the Galilee. So to me, as I look forward, this is a long, harsh, difficult war, one that we will prevail and withstand, but I really do think that there is still another whole stage in front of us.
Retired Colonel Miri Eisen, director of the International Institute for Counterterrorism at Reichman University, on the line from Herzliya in Israel, thank you so much for speaking with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Stay safe.
VOA Persian's Arash Zagarchi has been on the ground in Israel for more than 2 weeks, filing regular reports on the Israel-Hamas war for our Persian-speaking audience. I spoke to him by phone on Monday and asked what kinds of challenges he has been facing as he covers the conflict.
You know, it doesn't matter where you are. It's a war zone. It doesn't matter if you are in the hotel or Israeli parliament called Knesset. Right now, today, we were here and we heard alarms and then we just walked, actually run to shelters. It's because the missile is coming. The rockets are coming. So usually twice a week, I go to near Gaza border, honestly, to see what happened in October 7, because mostly kibbutz and villages there were attacked by Hamas forces. So every week we go there to see the evidence, to see what happened, and tell their story to our audience.
So when you went to those Israeli communities near the Gaza border, what did you see? And how did you feel when you saw what I'm sure were very shocking images?
Honestly, I had a first-hand experience to see what happened, because we had a chance to go to IDF and see it, look at the video they provided from Hamas cameras, from security cameras, stuff like that. But when I was in the field, when I was in the kibbutz, I saw how it happened, because in the video they showed us, Hamas forces attacked to the front line of one of the kibbutz, Be'eri, and they started shooting to the kiosk for security. In the kibbutz, when I went, I saw that, because there was a gate, there was a kiosk, everything. Or, you know, Hamas forces killing people. We went to Kfar Aza, which is only 1.5 miles far from Gaza border. We saw a house, their owner had a celebration annually to send a kite through the sky to Gaza to say we are together. It was the annual one was October 7 afternoon after Shabbat. But Hamas forces came to the house, came to the kibbutz, they killed everybody.
As you've been going around Israel, different parts of the country, you were telling me earlier that you have come across some other Persian-speaking journalists, some other Iranian journalists. So what kind of presence is there in Israel today from the Persian journalist community?
Actually, this war is very related to Iranian. When I talk with any politician in Israel, when I talk with any ordinary people, they put the finger on Iran. They said Iranian government funded Hamas. Some of them say they give a green light to Hamas to attack. Some of them say they give a moral support or something like that. So everybody here is talking about Iran's role and the war. So many Iranians want to know what's going on. Is that any possible direct or indirect attack by Israel to Iranian government or something like that? So they follow very closely. That's our role, to make sure we provide them news.
So what other Persian networks are operating in Israel besides VOA Persian?
I saw somebody from BBC Persian. I saw somebody from Iran International. And some Farsis, because I don't recognize their entity. And by the way, Israeli Defense Forces, they have a very good crew. They are Farsi speakers. They try to help us when we ask them to, you know, go to front line or someplace like that. They are very helpful, by the way.
What kinds of reactions have you seen on social media to the reports that you have been sending? The reports about the raw video that you watched from the Hamas cameras, your reports about being in the Israeli communities that were attacked, where massacres happened. What kinds of comments have your audience members been sending you?
I can divide the groups to three parts. First, pro-Israeli. Second, pro-Palestinian. But the big chunk is people who who are looking for facts and reality. Even today, almost 10 days after Gaza hospital explosion, Iranian state media reported, as a background of the story, just mentioned that, oh, Gaza hospital, which is struck by Israel. Factually, it's error. Everybody knows it wasn't Israel. Biden said, other countries said. And after that, even Palestinian became quiet on that. But even now, 10 days later, Iranian media trying to spread the lie, Israel was responsible. So that's our job, to say the facts. What's happening here in Israel? What's happening in Gaza? We have to say the facts. That's it.
And do you get the feeling that your audience is seeing that? Do you feel like the social media users recognize that you're trying to give people the facts?
I can feel that when we report, they come and read and give us some reaction, even public or privately, tell us, wow, I didn't know that. Oh, this one is good. Oh, that is fact. So we get some kind of reaction that is a good eager to us to do our job.
That's great to hear. Arash Sagarchi, VOA Persian reporter, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Thank you so much for telling us about your reporting experiences from this conflict.
Sure. Anytime, Micah. Thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Rights activists say Iranian authorities have cracked down on people mourning the death of Armita Garavand, a 17-year-old Iranian girl who collapsed on a Tehran metro train on October 1st when she apparently was confronted by morality police for not wearing a hijab. The collapse left Garavand in a coma until she died on Saturday. Authorities blamed a loss of blood pressure. Activists cited witnesses as saying morality police assaulted the teenager before she hit her head. Garavand was buried on Sunday at a Tehran cemetery, where activists reported a large deployment of security forces who arrested several people, including prominent dissident Nazrin Satoudeh. Nazanin Ansari is the managing editor of Persian news site Kayhan London. I asked her in a Monday phone call for her reaction to what happened at Garavand's funeral.
It wasn't surprising because this is what has been happening to many other families, to most families who have lost loved ones, specifically those who have lost their dear ones in the past year during the protests. Security officials and security forces have not only raided homes, arrested family members, and really banned any kind of demonstration of grief or even photos of these young protesters who have passed away, who were killed, unjustly killed. And indeed, there have been a few family members of these protesters who have had to flee because they were under the threat of arrest. And based on the news that we have been receiving and coverage from international media and even documentaries, recent documentaries that have been shown here in the United Kingdom on British TV, especially one last night that they had been filming undercover for a whole year, the degree of repression and crackdown is just mind-boggling. And it shows that there is a real state-sponsored terror modus operandi against Iranian civilians. So it hasn't been surprising.
What is the reaction of the people to the crackdown of the authorities and the messaging of the authorities about what happened to Armita Garavand?
They have lost trust in whatever the state says at the moment. I remember one of the newspapers in Iran had done a polling about the level of trust in reports coming from the government, and over 80% said they don't trust it. Certainly, after the protests, until a few months ago, we were seeing more women walking outside without the hijab. It was a form of civil disobedience, you could say, against the system. But it was also in areas and in malls controlled by IRGC, owned by members of the Revolutionary Guards, where there was a more degree of freedom given. It has to be balanced. The state itself is trying to balance giving some kind of freedom to some sectors of the population to control the degree of anger and just to allow saying that there is a normality going on. But at the same time, when we look at how the state has installed so many cameras in public spaces, looking at and checking the citizenry and facial recognition cameras that they have imported from China, and the amount of texts that people are receiving on their mobile phones that, oh, we have seen you without any head covering, or you were not covering your hair while driving your car. There is this climate of fear and repression. And speaking to some recent travelers from Iran just a week ago, they were saying that they are not seeing as many people walking without forced hijab because of the fear. And certainly this has been a policy of the regime in Tehran to spread fear and despair.
So when you talk about fear, you're saying that the authorities are imposing that in some areas, but also in other areas, they're easing up a little bit to make women feel more free to walk without a hijab. Is that what's going on?
Well, yes, they are allowing free hijab in certain malls. But at the same time, the legislations before the Islamic Assembly or the parliament, you might want to call it, is actually cracking down on those not following the mandatory hijab. For example, after the third or fourth time that they receive a caution, their cars can be possessed or they can receive lashes and up to 10 years in prison. So the punishment is increasing as well. And on top of that, you've got these plain clothes, ordinary citizens that are more religious being tasked with stopping ordinary people, just like the morality group that arrested Armita and beat her on the metro. So there is this kind of confusion as well that is really people are scared. But that doesn't mean that they have begun to say, okay, this is the way we will continue and we will accept it. Indeed, if I may just quote for you what Armita's father yesterday said at the funeral. And he was saying that, Armita, my daughter, I will die every hour with you because I was not a good father. And it is a shame for our family because in the history of our family, hair was never subject to veil. In our tribe, and because they come from Lorestan, the hair of our mothers and daughters are sacred. And we swore by the hair of our women. And he goes on to say that I, your father, accepted to live in this society that does not respect the dignity of its citizens, but I brought you up in this society that at the end of the day, they took your life away. But we're not going to sit still and we're not going to accept this. So it is a very heart-wrenching speech that he delivered. And it expressed the anger, the heartfelt anger of not only her, because after Armita, there will be other girls.
Nazanin Ansari, managing editor of Kayhan London and Kayhan Life, joining us on the line from the British capital. Great to have you back on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much.
That's a wrap of our show. We have more episodes on Apple and Google Podcasts. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for listening and come back in a week for the next Flashpoint Iran.